thoughtful and sensitive billionaires could be. The collection had turned out to be a perfectly gorgeous investment as well.
"That takes care of art," said Rumford.
Constant was about to return the photograph of Miss Canalzone to his billfold when he felt he held not one photograph, but two. There was a photograph behind that of Miss Canalzone. He supposed that that was a photograph of Miss Canalzone's predecessor, and he thought that he might as well show Rumford her, too. Show Rumford what a celestial Lulu he had given the gate to.
There's another one," said Constant, holding out the second photograph to Rumford.
Rumford made no move to take the photograph. He didn't even bother to look at it. He looked instead into Constant's eyes and grinned roguishly. Constant looked down at the photograph that had been ignored. He found that it was not a photograph of Miss Canalzone's predecessor. It was a photograph that Rumford had slipped to him. It was no ordinary photograph, though its surface was glossy and its margins white. Within the margins lay shimmering depths. The effect was much like that of a rectangular glass window in the surface of a clear, shallow coral bay. At the bottom of that seeming coral bay were three women, one white, one gold, one brown. They looked up at Constant, begging him to come to them, to make them whole with love. Their beauty was to the beauty of Miss Canalzone as the glory of the sun was to the glory of a lightning bug. Constant sank into a wing chair again. He had to look away from all that beauty in order to keep from bursting into tears.
"You can keep that picture if you like," said Rumford. "It's wallet size."
Constant could think of nothing to say.
"My wife will still be with you when you get to Titan," said Rumford. "But she won't interfere if you want to frolic with these three young ladies. Your son will be with you, too, but he'll be quite as broad-minded as Beatrice."
"Son," said Constant.
He had no son.
"Yes, a fine boy named Crono," said Rumford.
"Crono," said Constant.
"A Martian name," said Rumford. "He's born on Mars, by you, out of Beatrice."
"Beatrice?" said Constant.
"My wife," said Rumford.
He'd become quite transparent. His voice was becoming tinny, too, as though coming from a cheap radio.
"Things fly this way and that, my boy," he said, "with or without messages. It's chaos, and no mistake, for the universe is just being born. It's the great becoming that makes the light and the heat and the motion and bangs you from hither to yon."
"Predictions, predictions, predictions," said Rumford musingly.
"Is there anything else I should tell you? Oh, yes, yes, yes. This child of yours, this boy named Crono will pick up a little strip of metal on Mars," said Rumford, "and he will call it his good luck piece. Keep your eye on that good luck piece, Mr. Constant. It's unbelievably important."
Winston Niles Rumford vanished slowly, beginning with the ends of his fingers and ending with his grin. The grin remained some time after the rest of him had gone.
"See you on Titan," said the grin.
And then it was gone.
"Is it all over, Moncrief?"
Mrs. Winston Niles Rumford called down to the butler from the top of the spiral staircase.
"Yes, Mum, he's left," said the butler. "And the dog, too."
"And that Mr. Constant," said Mrs. Rumford,
said Beatrice. She was behaving like an invalid, tottering, blinking hard, making her voice like wind in the treetops. She wore a long white dressing gown whose soft folds formed a counterclockwise spiral in harmony with the white staircase. The train of the gown cascaded down the top riser, making Beatrice,
continuous with the architecture of the mansion. It was her tall, straight figure that mattered most in the display. The details of her face were insignificant. A cannonball substituted for her head would have suited the grand composition as well. But Beatrice did have a face, and an interesting one. It could be said that she looked like a buck-toothed Indian brave, but anyone who said that would have to add quickly that she looked marvelous. Her face, like the face of Malachi Constant, was a one-of-a-kind, a surprising variation on a familiar theme. A variation that made observers think, yes, that would be another very nice way for people to look. What Beatrice had done with her face, actually, was what any plain girl could do. She had overlaid it with dignity, suffering, intelligence, and a piquant dash of bitchiness. "Yes," said Constant from below, "that Mr. Constant is still here." He was in plain view, leaning against a column in the arch that opened onto the foyer. But he was so low in the composition, so lost in architectural details as to be almost invisible.
"Oh," said Beatrice, "how do you do?"
It was a very empty greeting.
"How do you do?" said Constant.
"I can only appeal to your gentlemanly instincts," said Beatrice, "in asking you not to spread the story of your meeting with my husband far and wide. I can well understand how tremendous the temptation to do so must be."
"Yes," said Constant. "I could sell my story for a lot of money, pay off the mortgage on the homestead, and become an internationally famous figure. I could hobnob with the great and near great, and perform before the crowned heads of Europe."
"You'll pardon me," said Beatrice, "if I fail to appreciate sarcasm and all the other brilliant nuances of your no doubt famous wit, Mr. Constant. These visits of my husband's make me ill."
"You never see him anymore, do you?" said Constant.
"I saw him the first time he materialized," said Beatrice, "and that was enough to make me ill for the rest of my days."
"I liked him very much," said Constant.
"The insane, on occasion, are not without their charms," said Beatrice.
"Insane," said Constant.
"As a man of the world, Mr. Constant," said Beatrice, "wouldn't you say that any person who made complicated and highly improbable prophecies was mad?"
"Well," said Constant, "is it really very crazy to tell a man who has access to the biggest spaceship ever built that he's going out into space?"
This bit of news about the accessibility of a spaceship to Constant startled Beatrice. It startled her so much that she took a step back from the head of the staircase, separated herself from the rising spiral. The small step backward transformed her into what she was, a frightened, lonely woman in a tremendous house.
"You have a spaceship, do you?" she said.
"A company I control has custody of one," said Constant. "You've heard of the Whale?"
"Yes," said Beatrice.
"My company sold it to the government," said Constant. "I think they'd be delighted if someone would buy it back at 5 cents on the dollar."
"Much luck to you on your expedition," said Beatrice.
Constant bowed.
"Much luck to you on yours," he said.
He left without another word. In crossing the bright zodiac on the foyer floor, he sensed that the spiral staircase now swept down rather than up. Constant became the bottommost point in a whirlpool of fate. As he walked out the door, he was delightfully aware of pulling the aplomb of the Rumford mansion right out with him. Since it was foreordained that he and Beatrice were to come together again to produce a child named Chrono, Constant was under no compunction to seek and woo her, to send her so much as a get-well card. He could go about his business, he thought, and the haughty Beatrice would have to damn well come to him, like any other bimbo. He was laughing when he put on his dark glasses and false beard and let himself out through the little iron door in the wall. The limousine was back, and so was the crowd. The police held open a narrow path to the limousine door. Constant scuttled down it, reached the limousine. The path closed like the Red Sea behind the children of Israel. The cries of the crowd, taken together, were a collective cry of indignation and pain. The crowd, having been promised nothing, felt cheated, having received nothing. Men and boys began to rock Constant's limousine. The chauffeur put the limousine in gear, made it creep through the sea of raging flesh. A bald man made an attempt on Constant's life with a hot dog, stabbed at the window glass with it, splayed the bun, broke the frankfurter, left a sickly sunburst of mustard and relish.
"Yah! Yah! Yah!"
yelled a pretty young woman, and she showed Constant what she had probably never showed any other man. She showed him that her two upper front teeth were false. She let those two front teeth fall out of place. She shrieked like a witch. A boy climbed on the hood, blocking the chauffeur's view. He ripped off the windshield wipers, threw them to the crowd. It took the limousine 3/4 of an hour to reach a fringe of the crowd. And on the fringe were not the lunatics, but the nearly sane. Only on the fringe did the shouts become coherent.
"Tell us!" shouted a man, and he was merely fed up, not enraged.
"We've got a right!"
shouted the woman. She showed her two fine children to Constant. Another woman told Constant what it was the crowd felt it had a right to.
"We've got a right to know what's going on!"
she cried. The riot, then, was an exercise in science and theology, a seeking after clues by the living as to what life was all about. The chauffeur, seeing at last a clear road before him, pressed the accelerator to the floor. The limousine zoomed away. A huge billboard flashed by. "Let's take a friend to the church of our choice on Sunday," it said. Chapter 2. Cheers in the Wirehouse.
"Sometimes I think it's a great mistake to have matter that can think and feel. It complains so. By the same token, though, I suppose that boulders and mountains and moons could be accused of being a little too phlegmatic."
Winston Niles Rumford. The limousine zoomed north out of Newport, turned down a gravel road, kept a rendezvous with a helicopter that was waiting in a pasture. The purpose of Malachi Constant's switch from the limousine to the helicopter was to prevent anyone's following him, to prevent anyone's discovering who the bearded and bespectacled visitor to the Rumford estate had been. No one knew where Constant was. Neither the chauffeur nor the pilot knew the true identity of their passenger. Constant was Mr. Jonah K. Rowley to both.
"Miss Rowley, sir?"
said the chauffeur, as Constant stepped out of the limousine.
"Yes," said Constant.
"Wasn't you scared, sir?"
said the chauffeur.
"Scared," said Constant, sincerely puzzled by the question. "Of what?"
"Of what?"
said the chauffeur incredulously.
"Why, of all them crazy people who'd like to lynch us."
Constant smiled and shook his head. Not once in the midst of the violence had he expected to be hurt.
"It hardly helps to panic, do you think?"
he said. In his own words, he recognized Rumford's phrasing, even a little of Rumford's aristocratic yodel.
"Man, you must have some kind of guardian angel lets you keep cool as a cucumber no matter what,"
said the chauffeur admiringly. This comment interested Constant, for it described well his attitude in the midst of the mob. He took the comment at first as an analogy, as a poetic description of his mood. A man who had a guardian angel would certainly have felt just as Constant had.
"Yes, sir," said the chauffeur. "Something sure must be looking out for you."
Then it hit Constant. This was exactly the case. Until that moment of truth, Constant had looked upon his Newport adventure as one more drug-induced hallucination, as one more peyotl party, vivid, novel, entertaining, and of no consequence whatsoever. The little door had been a dreamy touch, the dry fountain another, and the huge painting of the all-white touch-me-not little girl with the all-white pony, and the chimney-like room under the spiral staircase, and the photograph of the three sirens on Titan, and Rumford's prophecies, and the discomfiture of Beatrice Rumford at the top of the stairs. Malachi Constant broke into a cold sweat. His knees threatened to buckle, and his eyelids became unhinged. He was finally understanding that every bit of it had been real. He had been calm in the midst of the mob because he knew he wasn't going to die on Earth. Something was looking out for him, all right, and whatever it was saving his skin for... Constant quaked as he counted on his fingers the points of interest on the itinerary Rumford had promised him. Mars, then Mercury, then Earth again, then Titan. Since the itinerary ended on Titan, presumably that was where Malachi Constant was going to die. He was going to die there. What had Rumford been so cheerful about? Constant shuffled over to the helicopter, rocked the great ramshackle bird as he climbed inside.
"You rally?" said the pilot.
"That's right," said Constant.
"Unusual first name you got, Mr. Rowley," said the pilot.
Beg your pardon," said Constant nauseously. He was looking through the plastic dome of the cockpit cover, looking up into the evening sky. He was wondering if there could possibly be eyes up there, eyes that could see everything he did. And if there were eyes up there, and they wanted him to do certain things, go certain places, how could they make him? Oh, God, but it looked thin and cold up there.
"I said you've got an unusual first name," said the pilot.
"What name's that?" said Constant, who had forgotten the foolish first name he had chosen for his disguise.
"Jonah,"
said the pilot. 59 days later, Winston Niles Rumford and his loyal dog Kazakh materialized again. A lot had happened since their last visit. For one thing, Malachi Constant had sold out all his holdings in Galactic Spacecraft, the corporation that had the custody of the great rocket ship called the Whale. He had done this to destroy every connection between himself and the only known means of getting to Mars. He had put the proceeds of the sale into Moon Mist Tobacco. For another thing, Beatrice Rumford had liquidated her diversified portfolio of securities and had put the proceeds into shares of Galactic Spacecraft, intending thereby to get a leather-lunged voice in whatever was done with the Whale. For another thing, Malachi Constant had taken to writing Beatrice Rumford offensive letters, in order to keep her away, in order to make himself absolutely and permanently intolerable to her. To see one of these letters was to see them all. The most recent one went like this, written on stationery of Magnum Opus Incorporated, the corporation whose sole purpose was to manage the financial affairs of Malachi Constant.
"Hello from sunny California, space baby. Gee, I am sure looking forward to jazzing a high-class dame like you under the twin moons of Mars. You're the only kind of dame I never had, and I'll bet your kind is the greatest. Love and kisses for a starter. Mal."
For another thing, Beatrice had bought a capsule of cyanide, more deadly, surely, than Cleopatra's asp. It was Beatrice's intention to swallow it if ever she had to share so much as the same time zone with Malachi Constant. For another thing, the stock market had crashed, wiping out Beatrice Rumford, among others. She had bought Galactic Spacecraft shares at prices ranging from 151.5 to 169. The stock had fallen to 6 in 10 trading sessions, and now lay there, trembling fractional points. Since Beatrice had bought on margin as well as for cash, she had lost everything, including her Newport home. She had nothing left but her clothes, her good name, and her finishing school education. For another thing, Malachi Constant had thrown a party 2 days after returning to Hollywood. And only now, 56 days later, was it petering out. For another thing, a genuinely bearded young man named Martin Korodubian had identified himself as the bearded stranger who had been invited into the Rumford estate to see a materialization. He was a repairer of solar watches in Boston, and a charming liar. A magazine had bought his story for $3,000. Sitting in Skip's museum under the spiral staircase, Winston Niles Rumford read Korodubian's magazine story with delight and admiration. Korodubian claimed in his story that Rumford had told him about the year 10 million A.D. In the year 10 million, according to Korodubian, there would be a tremendous house cleaning. All records relating to the period between the death of Christ and the year 1 million A.D. would be hauled to dumps and burned. This would be done, said Korodubian, because museums and archives would be crowding the living right off the earth. The million-year period to which the burned junk related would be summed up in history books in one sentence, according to Korodubian. Following the death of Jesus Christ, there was a period of readjustment that lasted for approximately 1 million years. Winston Niles Rumford laughed and laid Korodubian's article aside. Rumford loved nothing more than a thumping good fraud.
10 million A.D., he said out loud. A great year for fireworks and parades and world's fairs. A merry time for cracking open quarter stones and digging up time capsules.
Rumford wasn't talking to himself. There was someone else in Skip's museum with him. The other person was his wife, Beatrice. Beatrice was sitting in the facing wing chair. She had come downstairs to ask her husband's help in a time of great need. Rumford blandly changed the subject. Beatrice, already ghostly in a white peignoir, turned the color of lead.
"What an optimistic animal man is," said Rumford rosily. "Imagine expecting the species to last for 10 million more years, as though people were as well designed as turtles."
He shrugged.
"Well, who knows? Maybe human beings will last that long, just on the basis of pure cussedness. What's your guess?"
"What?" said Beatrice.
"Guess how long the human race will be around," said Rumford.
From between Beatrice's clenched teeth came a frail, keen, sustained note so high as to be almost above the range of the human ear. The sound bore the same ghastly promise as the whistle of fins on a falling bomb. Then the explosion came. Beatrice capsized her chair, attacked the skeleton, threw it crashing into a corner. She cleaned off the shelves of Skip's museum, bouncing specimens off the walls, trampling them on the floor. Rumford was flabbergasted.
"Good God!" he said. "What made you do that?"
"Don't you know everything?" said Beatrice hysterically. "Does anybody have to tell you anything? Just read my mind!"
Rumford put his palms to his temples, his eyes wide.
"Static. All I get is static," he said.
"What else would there be but static?" said Beatrice.
"I'm going to be thrown right out in the street without even the price of a meal, and my husband laughs and wants me to play guessing games." "It wasn't any ordinary guessing game," said Rumford.
"It was about how long the human race was going to last.
I thought that might sort of give you more perspective about your own problems."
"The hell with the human race," said Beatrice.
"You're a member of it, you know," said Rumford.
"Then I'd like to put in for a transfer to the chimpanzees," said Beatrice.
"No chimpanzee husband would stand by while his wife lost all her coconuts. No chimpanzee husband would try to make his wife into a space whore for Malachi Constant of Hollywood, California."
Having said this ghastly thing, Beatrice subsided some. She wagged her head tiredly.
"How long is the human race going to be around, Master?"
"I don't know," said Rumford.
"I thought you knew everything.
said Beatrice. Just take a look at the future.
I look at the future, said Rumford, and I find that I shall not be in the solar system when the human race dies out. So the end is as much a mystery to me as to you.
In Hollywood, California, the chimes of the blue telephone in the rhinestone phone booth by Malachi Constant's swimming pool were ringing. It was always pitiful when any human being falls into a condition hardly more respectable than that of an animal. How much more pitiful it is when the person who falls has had all the advantages. Malachi Constant lay in the wide gutter of his kidney-shaped swimming pool, sleeping the sleep of a drunkard. There was a quarter of an inch of warm water in the gutter. Constant was fully dressed in blue-green evening shorts and a dinner jacket of gold brocade. His clothes were soaked. He was all alone. The pool had once been covered uniformly by an undulating blanket of gardenias, but a persistent morning breeze had moved the blooms to one end of the pool, as though folding a blanket to the foot of a bed. In folding back the blanket, the breeze revealed a pool bottom paved with broken glass, cherries, twists of lemon peel, peyotl buttons, slices of orange, stuffed olives, sour onions, a television set, a hypodermic syringe, and the ruins of a white grand piano. Cigar butts and cigarette butts, some of them marijuana, littered the surface. The swimming pool looked less like a facility for sport than like a punch bowl in hell. One of Constant's arms dangled in the pool itself. From the wrist underwater came the glint of his solar watch. The watch had stopped. The telephone's chimes persisted. Constant mumbled but did not move. The chimes stopped. Then, after 20 seconds, the chimes began again. Constant groaned, sat up, groaned. From the inside of the house came a brisk, efficient sound, high heels on a tile floor. A ravishing, brassy blonde woman crossed from the house to the phone booth, giving Constant a